Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Friday, December 6, 2024. People living with disabilities in South Sudan's capital, Juba, say HIV/AIDS has killed some of their members.
We have a small number of infected people. However, others don't want to reveal themselves. Until last year, we had more than 3 or 4 people who died from HIV.
And stigma is fueling the spread of HIV/AIDS in Upper Nile State.
Here in Malakal, there are a lot of cases, HIV cases, but a lot of people are hiding and they are fearing to show themselves. People don't want to accept that they have HIV/AIDS, and when they are told to go for tests, they may take it in different ways, that maybe you are telling them that they are prostitutes.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. People living with disabilities in South Sudan's capital, Juba, say a language barrier has kept them from learning about how the HIV/AIDS virus is ravaging the country. They are urging the government to provide them with life-saving information about HIV/AIDS. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi reports from Juba.
In 2022, the estimated HIV prevalence for people ages 15 to 49 was 1.9%. However, a survey of female sex workers in Juba found an estimated rate of 37.8%. The prevalence of HIV in the southern states of the Equatorial region is higher than the national average. Persons living with disabilities in Juba say a lack of awareness about HIV/AIDS across the country puts their lives in danger. Visually impaired Rhoda Atanasio, a leader of women living with disabilities in South Sudan, says most women affected by conflict are allegedly trapped into selling sex because of their vulnerability, putting them at risk of contracting HIV or AIDS.
We have a small number of infected people. However, others don't want to reveal themselves. Until last year, we had more than 3 or 4 people who died from HIV. Many people became infected with HIV for several reasons, due to poverty, sometimes due to lack of money. So men trick them with words or money, so they end up having sex without knowing the health condition of the person they are intercourse with.
Catherine Jura is the director of gender in the Ministry of Health. She says conflicts and cultural stereotypes have worsened among vulnerable South Sudanese.
For instance, in times of emergencies, they have no shelters, nobody's there to take care of them, and wherever they go, they are being sodomized, the boys and the ladies are being raped, so they're exposed to much more harm than ordinary people. Because the relatives or the communities even don't tend to take care of the disabled. Mostly they are just left on their own.
Rhoda says HIV or AIDS awareness campaigns are needed to help persons with disability fight HIV/AIDS.
We must be protected by being trained on how to do this. Prevention is important so that we don't find ourselves infected. But if trained on protection, you will be healthy and protect your body.
Emmanuel Monoja is a counselor who works with disabled people. He says HIV/AIDS education should be introduced in schools across South Sudan.
Most of them are not educated and they are just staying at home and they are not open to the society. So to communicate with these people, it becomes difficult. For the hearing impairment, it needs someone who can know sign language. And here we have limited persons who know sign language. And then for those who are hearing, most of them do not go to school, and some of the information that are to be passed to them is supposed to be read, and they are not educated, so education is really very, very important.
Dr. Esterina Novello, the chairperson of the South Sudan HIV/AIDS Commission, called on South Sudanese to know their HIV/AIDS status.
And prevalent with HIV and bigger gains,
there is a decline in HIV prevalence, which is not what happened in the past. When we started, it was 2.3, but now the ratio has reached to 1.6. This is a better achievement and an achievement for us to brag about. But still, if you go to the Eastern Equatorial State, in Torit, there are some cases, in Yambio, in Awil, in Rumbek and Malakal, all states in South Sudan.
According to UNAIDS, people with disabilities in South Sudan have limited access to HIV/AIDS information, education, counseling and health care services, including ARVs. The impact of HIV/AIDS on people with disabilities in South Sudan remains unknown. Earlier this week, the U.S. government invested $42 million to support over 87% of the 63,000 South Sudanese currently on HIV treatment. The U.S. embassy in Juba urged the transitional government to use public revenue to strengthen the health system by investing in health care facilities, training health care workers, and ensuring equitable access to quality care for all. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
Still on HIV/AIDS, authorities in Upper Nile State say they worry about the number of people living with HIV/AIDS. They say migration, poverty, insecurity, and lack of awareness are to blame for the silent spread of the disease in the state. Mamer Abraham Kwart reports for VOA from Malakal Town.
Health officials say people living with HIV in South Sudan often face discrimination in workplace, family, and other areas of life, leading to stress and isolation. Health watchdog groups and international nonprofits advocating sexual behavioral change say many people in South Sudan are misinformed about HIV/AIDS and how it spreads. Joseph Obonyo, director of the state's HIV/AIDS Commission, says there are many people living with the disease in Upper Nile State. He says stigma and other cultural assumptions about HIV/AIDS have accelerated the spread of the disease, and other structural challenges have hampered the ability of the commission to function well.
We have the lack of mobility for the coordination with the partners, lack of the office equipment, lack of capacity building for our staff because we have newly appointed staff, low level of awareness in the state, and the high level of stigma and discriminations. We have a good numbers of the people here. But to give the testimony that I'm living positive, because of the level of stigma, it is very difficult. Very difficult. Maybe it goes back to literacy. People are not well educated.
Malakal resident Bill Ward says negative perceptions about individuals who are HIV positive allow the disease to spread in the town.
Here in Malakal, there are a lot of cases, HIV cases, but a lot of people are hiding and they are fearing to show themselves. People don't want to accept that they have HIV/AIDS, and when they are told to go for tests, they may take it in different way that maybe you are telling them that they are prostitutes.
An official with HIV/AIDS Commission in Malakal says out of 11,000 people tested across the state, 533 were HIV positive. Obonyo says transmission of HIV/AIDS also occurs among commercial sex workers who operate undercover in South Sudan.
Now, if you go to East Africa, I think these commercial sex workers are allowed. But in our context in South Sudan here, it is illegal. We do it illegally. But even most dangerous than the one which is open. But those are the most driving ones. They are there. But they will not say that we are commercial sex workers.
Nasir County resident Boyn Lam says voluntary HIV testing centers are not available in Nasir.
It is very hard because you know the ideology of those people. If they're not convinced, I don't think they will do the test. As for me, because I want to know exactly what I have, if they often I will go for testing because I will exactly know what I have. They just advertise this thing called vaccine. I think they are going to do that and maybe they will catch more cases.
Beni Kwajian, Director for Monitoring and Evaluation at the Upper Nile State's Ministry of Health, says the official HIV/AIDS infection rate in the state will be made available to the public soon.
I think now there's an increase of people living with HIV. That was HIV when you mention it by yourself. Even people can run away from you. The stigma is so high. People are fearing also even to go to know your home is better. Even people are mentioning that when they go to the hospital, they are feeling like they have a malaria. They don't want to say, let me go and know my status with HIV. Because there's no awareness in the state. When they say there's a HIV, meaning that they even call you dead.
UNFPA estimates that HIV prevalence among people between the ages of 15 and 49 in South Sudan is 2.4%, while women and girls constitute 64% of new HIV infections. The UN agency says poverty, insecurity, and lack of proper reproductive health services have contributed to the rapid spread of HIV/AIDS in Upper Nile State. For VOA News, I am Amer Abraham Kwot, reporting from Upper Nile State's capital, Malakal.
From Malakal, we move to Kenya, where men from indigenous communities are campaigning against female genital mutilation through their action dubbed Men and FGM. They are sensitizing communities where cultural norms and traditions like FGM run deep. For VOA News, Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
Naomi Kolian recounts the ordeal at her parents' house at the age of 13. Kolian, now a mother of five, says her parents arranged for her genital mutilation during a school break. She had just taken her national examination. She says, they stripped off my clothes, poured water on me. I passed out. When I recovered, I realized a certain woman was already cutting me. Out of pain, I tried to jump, so they tied both of my legs with ropes. As of 2021, at least 14.8% of Kenyan women, like Kolian, had undergone female genital mutilation or FGM, according to the Britain-based FGMC Research Initiative. 45.6% of them are cut between 5 and 9 years of age. It is seen as a rite of passage for girls that is a compulsory step before marriage. Now men are stepping up to end the practice. Through a movement dubbed Men End FGM, they're educating others on the dangers of FGM. The movement's executive director, Tony Mwebia, says most men in the communities that support FGM are ignorant of what the cut entails and are always providing resources and guarding the FGM ceremonies.
As Men End FGM, what we do is we go and have conversations with the men. We show them the visual materials. We use a lot of charts. We use videos. We use photos of complications in labor wards.
At least 600 men like Noah Sampeke, a senior chief in Kenya's Kajiado County, have joined the movement that started as an online campaign. Sampeke says he regrets keeping the tradition of marrying only women that have undergone the cut. He says that he comes from a community where it was compulsory for women to get the cut, and if she got pregnant without the cut, she was considered an outcast. But now I will not force my girls to get the cut. In November, Kenya women rights activists began 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, among which female genital mutilation is the most egregious violation, according to advocates. They say a collective movement for change is crucial. Ajra Mohammed is country representative for Nguvu Collective, a women's advocacy group.
They might think because we have very strict regulations, people will avoid FGM, while on the ground, people are actually hiding it, and the community leaders are supporting that. So if you connect them with the grassroots activists, they'll be able now to inform them, like to be their allies and to be their whistleblowers.
Kenya ratified the Prohibition of Female Genital Mutilation Act in 2011 and established an anti-FGM board, an agency that spearheads campaigns to eradicate FGM. The agency's CEO, Bernadette Loloju, told VOA that the board is promoting alternative rites of passage like training girls into adulthood without a cut. FGM slightly declined from 21% to 15% in 2022 demographic health survey. Officials believe that the approach of incorporating men will help eradicate FGM. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, African business women are facing difficulties. Find out why after the break. You You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Businesses started by women have received less than 5% of venture capital funding in Africa over the past decade, according to a new report. The report says investment in female-started businesses decreased further last year, frustrating businesswomen and those who want to invest to give them greater consideration. Muhammad Yusuf reports for VOA from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Female-founded businesses are the driving force behind innovation and inclusive growth in Africa, according to a report by business research platform Brita Bridges and non-profit organization V54 Open Impact. However, female business owners face many challenges when seeking investment to help grow their businesses. Akosua Lefti is a Ghanaian businesswoman who specializes in developing products for natural hair. She says over her 2 years in business, she has struggled to attract interest from potential investors.
Word of mouth, I send my product, I discuss it with them. Sometimes they go like, oh, we'll see, I'll reach out to you about it or something, but it never comes. And sometimes friends, you talk to a couple of friends, they go like, okay, what will my percentage be and all of that? But this is something like you are starting out, so it will be difficult to actually tell. And there will be pressure if it doesn't pick off immediately, because people want to make back their money immediately they give it to you.
Brita Bridges and V54 Open Impact say that of all the capital venture funding across Africa in the past 10 years, less than 5% went to women founders. Elizabeth Mwangi is the founder of Gwiji, which connects women cleaners to clients. Mwangi got her first funding in 2020, which has helped her develop an app that could help support and empower women to make a living.
The next funding I got was in 2023. And that time I was almost giving up on Gwiji. And it's an award that I won, a global award that focuses on women. We call Aurora Sec Award. From there, I was able to get a funding of $30,000. And that one actually enabled us to advance. That time we didn't have an office. So we were able to have an office, a safe space for these women. We were able to launch a secondary program that helped to ensure we have holistic empowerment of our women.
Mwangi says she is partnering with more organizations like the UK government-backed Transform to widen her reach beyond Nairobi.
The aim for this is to help us empower more women for informal settlement even beyond Nairobi, because Gwiji currently is in Nairobi. But you find that every day we get calls from women from different areas in Kenya who want to join Gwiji and be able to...
A landmark climate change case opened at the United Nations International Court of Justice in The Hague this week, aimed at clarifying the legal obligations of states to prevent climate change and to pay for any damage it causes. Several small island nations argue their very survival is at stake, as Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
It has been described as the biggest court case in the world. Judges at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, the United Nations' top legal body, have been asked to rule on whether major polluting nations can be held to account for causing climate change and its harmful effects. Smaller island nation states say rising sea levels place their very existence at stake. Arnold Keel Lockman, the Attorney General of Vanuatu, a small island state in the South Pacific, gave evidence to the court on Monday.
Under international law, states have obligations. Obligation to act with due diligence, to prevent significant harm to the environment, to reduce the emissions and provide support to countries like mine, to protect the human rights of present and future generations.
The judges will consider not only legally binding climate agreements, but also international human rights law. The court is hearing testimony from countries responsible for much of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, including the United States. Margaret Taylor is a State Department legal advisor who is representing the United States at the International Court of Justice.
International human rights law, however, does not obligate states to mitigate anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. nor does it currently provide for a human right to a healthy environment. Although the United States remains open to participating in a state-led process to develop such a right.
Many big polluters argue that the only relevant laws are derived from existing climate agreements and that other legislation isn't relevant, says Nikki Reich of the Center for International Environmental Law.
We effectively heard them argue that the only relevant law from which we any legal obligations can be sourced is the Paris Agreement. And when you actually look at the text of that agreement, it doesn't require very much. We heard the U.S. really trying to encourage the court and others to ignore history, to sweep the historical conduct of many decades of emissions under the rug and saying that what happened before the climate agreement was adopted doesn't really matter from a legal perspective.
The judge's opinion won't be legally binding, but it will carry weight, says Reich.
As a kind of legal blueprint for accountability or a guide for courts and advocates around the world to understand what international law requires and what we should be holding states to in terms of their climate action and their measures to remedy climate harm.
Representatives from almost 100 countries and intergovernmental organizations will testify to the court, with the hearing due to end on December 13th. The judges are expected to deliver their opinion next year. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
From London, we go to Ghana, where nearly 18.8 million Ghanaians who registered to vote will be able to take part Saturday in the country's ninth general election since multi-party politics was reintroduced in the early 1990s. In the last 30 years, the country has had a series of closely fought but peaceful polls. VOA's Paul Ndiho is in Ghana's capital, Accra, closely monitoring the preparations for the vote. He tells my colleague Yehia Swihib that Ghana has had a reputation of orderly transfers of power between administrations, and the situation a day before the elections is very calm.
Well, I'm downtown Accra. I've been driving around since morning. It's a little bit calm compared to what it was yesterday. Yesterday, it was full of fanfare, jubilation. Every candidate, the major candidates had their rallies here in Accra. But today, it's a little bit quiet. So people are going on about their daily day-to-day business.
Going about their daily day-to-day business, how is the security situation there a day before the election?
You know, Ghana is one of those countries where that security is not a big deal. We've had transition after transition. We've had very smooth and peaceful elections in Ghana. For the last cycles of elections that have happened, no major incidents have happened. I don't see anything as of today. I've not seen anything to suggest that there's going to be a security threat or anything of that nature.
And Paul, 18.8 million Ghanaians registered to vote will be able to take part in the country's ninth general election tomorrow. Who are the front runners for the presidency in Saturday's election?
Well, there are a couple of front runners. There are over five candidates running for president, but at least two major candidates, Vice President Muhammadu Bawumia and former President John Dramani Mahama. Those are the two major candidates who are running, but it's increasingly looking like those two candidates, the election is going to be between those two candidates.
That was VOA's Paul Ndiho speaking with my colleague Yehia Swihib from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. It's that time we listen to you about what we do on this show. We are open to all your suggestions. Send your comments to us. And our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We start with this listener who recorded himself. We are facing technical difficulties with that audio, but nevertheless, we will pursue. Mading Malwal in Juba writes, congratulations to our listener and commentator Jacob Dior Machweng for graduating today at Mount Kenya University. This is a significant accomplishment, and I'm sure you must be feeling very proud and excited. I wish him all the best in his future endeavors. Johnson in Juba writes, the money collected from truck drivers by the National Security Services at the checkpoints or roadblocks in Aru Junction and other roadblocks, if managed well, will pay the salaries of all soldiers. That's according to Johnson, who writes from Juba. Michael Duart Garang Deng from Ajumani in Uganda writes, hello, boys and girls in Jungle Estate. Let's talk honestly about sex and relationship. Whether you use a condom or not, engaging in sexual activities outside of marriage can have serious consequences for your physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being. I want to encourage all of you to make a conscious decision to prioritize your health, dignity, and future. Let us strive to reduce sexual activities to 0% and focus on building healthy, respectful relationships. You are available and deserving of respect and care, compassion. Let's support each other in making positive choices that will benefit our lives and communities. Stay safe, stay informed, and stay empowered. Views expressed in these segments does not represent the views of the management of the South Sudan in Focus or VOA. Send us your comments. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. Your comments must be brief, otherwise we don't have space for long comments. That's all we prepared for you this Friday, December 6, 2024. We now leave you with the song Siri Yangu. Listening to Lady J and the song Siri Yangu. Siri Yangu in Kiswahili means my secret. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Jumbe Hamza, we wish you a lovely evening. If you are listening to us from Gudele, remember to join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Sito imba tena nalia, eliyobaki ni kusema nimekubali.